Yo, 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 and welcome back to Creeps and Crimes
Podcast.
I'm Taylor.
I'm Morgan. Happy Thursday and happy episode
207.
207.
207. Yeah, that has to be right. Yep.
You guys like the old chairs?
Yeah, old chairs are back for today, the gray ones.
So really, last week was your last view of the studio.
Yeah, yeah, of the original season 4 studio. Season 5 just doesn't even sound right. I'm sorry.
No.
It doesn't.
Never thought I would be here.
Never thought I would
so
be here.
So the next 2 weeks you will... 2-3 weeks.
2 weeks.
Next 2 weeks you will receive creepy... account.
Creepy account. So if you have a cryptid creepy account or something crazy that you want to write in, super, like, we're kicking off spooky season, you yes. know? So give us your all right here. Like, lay
it's
it all out.
It's time to get creepy.
If your grandma has a crazy ass story, go interview grandma and send that shit to us ASAP.
Someone see Bigfoot last week?
Let us
yeah,
know.
You did. Write it up.
Write it up, babes. So send us those in because this is your last on video recording of the stud. After this, she is gone.
No more dusty ass curtains.
No more wrinkly, dusty, musty curtains. No more. Should we tell them to kiss her goodbye?
Yeah.
Okay. Guys, this is truly like, where are the bagpipes at right now? This is...
Wait, pause.
Today we gather to give thanks to the pink neon Creeps and Crime sign.
May she rest easy.
In the corner of the studio. No longer on camera. Thanks, girl.
Should we give her a kiss?
Yeah.
We should give her a little kiss.
We should give her a little kissy kiss.
This is for the little creeps.
Mwah. She was so good to us, guys.
We love her.
She was the first thing that we ordered when we picked the name of Creeps and Crimes. She has been there since every recording.
You know where I actually think she needs to go?
Where? Behind...
Right where we're looking.
Yeah, definitely.
Day.
Definitely has
to be. We need to look
there.
At her.
Because, like, we're never going to take this down. It just... It's no longer...
She's probably going to hang on that window for a year. Let's be real.
Let's be so fucking real. That's what
she's not moving.
That's what's happening. But guys, yeah, she's going away. So this is her last day on duty. Yeah, and we just...
I mean, she's held so well. Drop the fucking link. Because if anyone needs...
They're shut down. I tried to go get us a new one.
I mean, how long has she been on? Probably close to...
For 4 years. For
5,000 hours.
For 207 Thursdays, she has been on.
And not to mention that it's not even just an hour. These are like 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 hour episodes.
Yes. And
really.
She's always on if we're recording, even if it's Patreon. Yeah. Patreon, she comes on for them. So it's really sad.
That's so sad.
That's really sad.
That's heartbreaking.
She's not going away, though. She's staying. It's just she's no longer.
Oh.
She needs to retire, guys. She needs to go to fucking Aruba. She wants to just go, like, kick her feet up. She's over our bullshit. She's fighting demons constantly.
I mean, she's literally had Christmas lights, spider webs.
Fingerprints.
Four-leaf clovers.
Double-sided tape with pictures of Marilyn Monroe.
Everything.
Yeah. She's been through it.
Oh, well.
She was a great girl.
Time to fucking go, babe.
Time to go, babe. So, this is your last time in the stud. Last week was normal, but...
We're really excited for the studio, but I'm not gonna lie. I'm scared to death.
Oh, I'm terrified. Just...
Like, what we have to do to the wall is a trust the process moment.
Yeah.
And I know we're gonna panic.
We just... What I keep having to tell myself is if we just do it right and don't be bitches... It'll happen and it'll be perfect because we can do anything that we put our minds to. We have done it in the past and we will be doing it again.
Should we halo light her from the top right above us? Like just phasing
she just
us?
She floats above
and
us.
So when we look up, it's like.
Creeps and Crimes. We could put it above the door outside and it's on when we're recording. Don't come in.
Yeah, on air.
Yeah, on air. We do need an on air sign.
For the cats.
We would literally never turn it on.
Logan doesn't bother us anymore.
No, he used to a lot more.
Yeah.
He learned his lesson after 4 years.
I think he used to a lot more because his door was just like right there.
Yeah.
Now he's got to like walk across the hallway and it's more time to think like door shut. They'll
she
kill
must
me.
Be working. Yeah, yeah, definitely. Because my door's never shut unless yeah. we're in here working. Guys, this weekend we got to work with Kate. Yes, from the Mississippi College Storytelling Institute.
It was so fun.
It was so much fun. Kate, we get to hang out with her and her girls.
Let me tell you guys a little story about me. Kate, Taylor, and the girls. I'm sitting here and I have my legs crossed. We're in these chairs because they're just easier to capture, like, both of us together, besides our big fucking bulky black
circle chairs,
circle
swivels,
moons that we have
that are
there.
Literally 2 feet off the ground.
Literally,
these are like, feel like I'm 6 foot tall,
yeah,
sitting in them.
So I'm sitting there and I have these heels on, and we get up to take a break. Taylor has to pee, and I'm like, oh, I'll go pee too. So I stand up and I say out loud, I'm like, oh, my foot's like falling asleep and my ankle rolls just a little bit. I'm like, I'm getting my balance again. I'm like, oh, it's really gone. My ankle is just numb. And my, it snaps in half.
She keeps saying, I'm going down. I think I'm going down.
I fall so hard to the ground. I'm laying on the ground. And I've never been more embarrassed in my life. But it was so funny because I was like, it's giving.
Patreon knows
it's
this.
It's giving Los Angeles. It's giving
Taylor
California.
At Chippendales.
It's giving Taylor. And Kate knew exactly what we were talking about.
Because she's a Patreon. And holy shit.
It was so funny.
I came over to help you get up, but I couldn't move.
I mean, I was laughing so hard.
I was having to fight not pissing my pants because I had to pee so bad.
Kate, and
I was,
I'm glad you got to see that.
Babe. I laughed about that the other night when I was in the shower. I was cackling about it. It was so fucking funny. And then I forgot to mention that a few weeks ago, remember how Morgan was like the day that she had the baby shower and she was at Target and she ran into our listener there?
Yes.
So I ran into that exact same listener, Anna, at the same exact same Target like a week later, and she was also on the phone with her mom this time because
so
she was
weird.
On the phone with your mom the last time, and she goes,
at this point, Anna, I'm thinking that she's like, has these intentions, like, I'm gonna go to Target today and I'm definitely gonna see Morgan
and then
Taylor.
You just like, so you're the one that makes a Target call to me.
Exactly.
Is that what it is, Anna?
We're sitting on the couch, we're like, Target, because it's really Anna over there, like,
she's making spells.
Making potions.
Literally.
We're just kidding, Anna, we know you don't think
no,
it was
you're
that
not
much
doing that. Also, Anna, this is really funny because I was mentioning this to Logan because I was like, oh, I can't forget to bring this up in the intro. I was telling Logan, you know, I was like, I gotta remember that, do you remember that? Because he was with me there that day, but I was in the dollar section. It's definitely not the dollar section, it's like the $5 section now of Target. Yeah,
that's crap.
Waiting on Logan to come out of the bathroom. So that's where I ran into her.
Mm-hmm.
Well, whenever me and her got done talking, I went back and started looking through the clothes. I went back and looked at the shoes. I went back to the electronics department, and I'm waiting on Logan because he's still not come out. So I call him and I'm like, yo, are you okay? And he's like, yeah, I'm looking for you. And I'm like, well, where are you? How long were you in the bathroom for? And he's like, I came out when you were talking to the girl. And I was like, what? And he said, yeah, I walked up behind your cart and I grabbed it when y'all were talking, but you didn't see me. And I was afraid that she was going to think I was just a creepy man coming up to you guys. So I just ran away.
Oh, my God.
And I said, Logan, first off, that makes you look more creepy than if you would have just been like, hey, babe, I'm here, and I could have introduced you. And he was like, I know, but I panicked and I didn't know what to do, because what if she's never followed you on Instagram and didn't know what my face was like? And I was like, I don't know, but I could have introduced you.
Logan's me. I would have thought that. I would have been like,
overthought it completely.
I'm so scared.
And ran away. He ran away from me. And I was like, well, did she see you? And he said, yeah, I think she did, because I like leaned over and smiled at her. And he said, that's when I realized I was being a creep. And I ran away.
That's a man that smiled.
And I was like, well, fuck, I'm going to have to tell her about this now.
Oh,
so she doesn't
funny.
Think that you're a creep. I don't know.
Oh, creepy Logan.
But that was it. This weekend we head to Nashville that we're going to be filming our season 5 trailer.
Oh, it's like, it's going to be crazy.
Going to be big.
It's
going to
be
so
hilarious.
Fun. It's going to be so funny.
I got to get my acting back up.
Yeah.
I got to really.
I'm just like not good at acting.
No, me.
I really hate it too, because I feel like I'm lying. You know what I mean? Like, and I'm not a good liar.
I just hate it because I get so uncomfortable and just awkward. And I'm like, I look so stupid.
Dude, David did, when I was talking to David on the phone, trying to get the address.
Was he worried about me?
He was like, I just want to, you know, let you guys both know. And I know Morgan told me to always keep her in mind about this, but like, we're going to have significantly a lot more people on set watching.
I know.
And so I just want to make sure that you guys go ahead and get in the mindset of that. But just make sure
Morgan
knows.
That just made my heart drop.
I know. And I was like, no, we know, but we've been ignoring that. We've been just straight up ignoring it. Yeah,
and then when I saw that one email that had like all everyone, like, are you good here for lighting? Are you good here for, you know, acting? Are you good here for pictures? I'm like, this is a lot of people.
Yeah. Yeah.
I just need the beer guy and the watching football in the back.
Swear to God.
And Nate and David. That's all I can
handle. That's it. That's all that we need.
And the cat.
Yeah, and the cat. We definitely
That's all back. I can handle. So, we like are progressively adding more.
Yeah, every time. It's becoming more and more of a production. So that's happening this weekend. We're really excited about it. Patreon, we'll talk to you guys more about it on Pipe and Hot Goss. And then after that, guys, the second we get home, kiss this bitch goodbye after we catch up on some sleep.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what I was really worried about. I'm like, I'm going to have to
I'm really sick over it. Sleep
all day Sunday.
I know. That's what I told Logan. I was like, take anything off the calendar, including bothering me.
Literally.
Because I'm going to come home and I have to go to bed because we're going to have to be picking up and moving fast. Because the week next week is when we have like all the recordings.
And it took us 2 weeks to recover from Los Angeles.
Yeah. And that, yeah. But guys, I guess we'll get into it. Since Morgan gave you a creepy last week, we're going all crimes and
yeah, baby.
Boy, I took that job serious.
Yes, she did.
I sure did. Okay, hit him with it.
If you're driving, throw that shit on cruise control.
If you got a glass, pour that shit up.
And let's get creepy.
Hold up. Before we move on, we've got to talk to you about someone that you know very well. Someone who changed our hair goals, everything that we know about water even. This is P-R-O-S-E. Pros.
Pros has taught us so many things, including how everyone's hair type is unique in its own way and how that could create a concern for you if not treated properly.
Like a perfect example of this is the fact that Morgan has really naturally dry skin, and because of that, hair, and me, I am a oily girly. I am so oily all the time. You can make biscuits and gravy with all my oil that I've got. But because I'm so oily, the same shampoo and conditioner that Morgan uses for her hair will probably not work for mine, at least long term. Even where you live has a lot to do with the way that your hair is going to be affected by different shampoos and conditioners. So the way that Pros has combated this is they've created personalized, unique to you hair care.
Like Taylor said, the best thing that Pros has done is create a unique formula that will address any specific type of concern that you may have for your hair, because this formula is based on you. If you're wondering whether custom hair care is worth the hype, let us tell you that it is, and that's why we are obsessed with Pros.
Since 2017, Pros has transformed traditional hair and skincare with a made-to-order model that reduces waste, celebrates unique beauty over one-size-fits-all beauty standards, and works better than off-the-shelf alternatives.
Since I've switched to Pros, I've noticed that my dry, brittle hair is softer, shinier, and fuller. And because you're always changing, so is your Pros. They can evolve your formula alongside you, and Pros will address any new concerns, adjust your formulas with the seasons, and learn from your feedback for an always custom fit.
Pros is so confident that you'll bring out your best hair that they're offering an exclusive trial offer of 50% off. That's 50% off of your first hair care subscription order at pros.com/CACBesties.
So take your free consultation, get your one-of-a-kind formulas, and see the difference custom hair care can make with 50% off, 50, at Pros, PROSE.com/CACBesties.
Thanks, Pros.
Thanks, Pros. We love you.
Alrighty, guys, we are going to be covering the dating game killer today. This is a serial killer, and I need to give you a lot of trigger warnings. This is extremely disturbing. If you're not in a place that you think you can handle this today, hold off and come back to it.
I'm not.
Oh, too bad for you.
I don't get the option.
Too bad for you, babe.
Must be nice.
So, trigger warnings for crimes against children, sexual crimes against children, sadism, sodomy, narcissism, and other psychological discussions, gruesome details, and just like a really fucked up person.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you for that. Thank you for choosing this. This is the last episode.
This is my last case of season 4, so I had to blow it out.
Yeah, really?
Yeah.
Really had to get in there, huh?
Had to get in there. So we're going to start on June 20th, 1979 in Huntington Beach, California. 12-year-old Robin Christine Samso was so excited for her first day of ballet lessons at a local studio scheduled for that afternoon, which also doubled as her first day of work at her new job because she had made this deal with the studio owner where she would like answer the phones at the front desk in exchange for free ballet classes. But that morning, before heading to the studio, Robin met up with her very best friend in the entire world, Bridget, at the beach to hang out and just like play before she had to go in. After a little bit of the girls hanging out, Bridget noticed a tall man with dark, long, shaggy hair and a camera around his like chest and arm, you know, kind of watching them. And in an interview that she did with 48 Hours, she said that it was as if she watched this man hone in on her and Robin, because it was like the second she laid eyes on him, he walks over to the two of them and says like, "Hey girls, can I take your picture? I'm a photographer." And immediately Robin, being 12 years old, says, "Sure, of course." The girls kind of get together and began posing as this man pulls his camera up to his face. But as the man begins to snap this first photo, Bridget's neighbor, who she refers to as Miss Jackie, approaches the girls and the man, asking if everything was all right, because she had just so happened to have been walking by and saw that entire interaction between this man and the two girls and was like, "Something's wrong." So she went up and was like, "Girls, is everything okay?" Well, within seconds of Jackie walking up and opening her mouth, this man with the camera sped walked off and disappeared with his head down. It was like the second she walked up, they looked at her, they looked back, he's gone. Leaving all three of them, Jackie, Bridget, and Robin, with this ominous feeling. The girls began packing up their bag to leave, with Miss Jackie waiting around so that she could walk Bridget home. As for Robin, though, she had to get to the dance studio for her lessons and first day of work. Worried about her, Bridget, her best friend, hands her her bike and says to Robin, "Take my bike and don't stop until you get there, okay?" Robin agreed, thanked Bridget, jumped on her best friend's bike, and began pedaling towards this dance studio. And unfortunately, this would be the last time Robin was ever seen or heard from. An hour or so later, Robin's mother, Marianne, was at home when the phone rang. It was a ballet studio owner, Robin's new teacher slash boss, calling to see if Robin was okay because she had missed her first session. Panicked, Marianne called Bridget's mother, where she learned the story about the man from the beach and Robin riding Bridget's bike to the studio because she was so scared. Marianne's heart sank. She hung up with Bridget's family and immediately called 911, reporting her 12-year-old daughter, Robin, missing. Investigators immediately jumped on Robin's case the second that it came in, working with Bridget and Miss Jackie to get a description of this creepy man and performing searches of the area, sending out bolos in hopes that they would find Robin. Maybe she fell off the bike and got hurt and, you know, went to the hospital, but she never was found until 12 days later. On July 2nd, 1979, during a routine fire prevention maintenance checkup off Santa Anita Canyon Road, where fire crews discovered the mostly skeletal remains of a small child. It took 3 days for investigators to be able to confirm that this was Robin, which they could only do using dental record comparisons. Upon this discovery, a composite sketch of the creepy beach photographer man from Bridget's description was blasted to the public. Soon after these sketches were released, a parole officer reached out to the detectives on Robin's case with a tip. According to this parole officer, the sketch had to be one of their parolees, 35-year-old Rodney James Alcala. Investigators immediately began digging into Alcala's past, and what they found truly shocked them to their core. Rodney James Alcala was born Rodrigo Jacques Alcala Bicor on August 23, 1943 in San Antonio, Texas, as the third of four children belonging to Raul Alcala Bicor and Anna Maria G. From a very young age, it was extremely clear that Rodney was incredibly intelligent. In school, he was in every gifted program and he excelled. He was super kind, friendly, gentle, and charming, even as a child. And at the age of eight in 1951, Rodney's father, Raul, moved his wife and their four children to his hometown in Mexico to find better work. But after only 3 months of being there, after picking up his whole family and making the moves from San Antonio, Texas, Raul abandons the family, just leaves one day to go to work, and never comes back.
The fuck?
Yeah, he was just like, he's alive. He didn't get killed or anything. He just ran away.
As a grown man.
As a grown man. Leaving his wife with four kids. Yeah. So, Anna Maria.
I don't get it. Like, what goes through someone's mind?
Just
like,
let me tell you something. Get up and go. If Logan ever did that to me, he better be fucking praying to God every night that I don't find him.
Right.
Because if I found
and
you.
And I would make it a mission. I would hunt you down.
I would hunt you.
You would, with all four kids in my car.
Oh yeah, they would.
Let's
you
go,
just see
for daddy.
I would literally put pictures of all of us on their windows at night, so they would wake up in the morning and look out the window and see pictures of us. I would haunt you. I would fucking haunt you. Don't ever do that to me.
Or just like sneak in and like just a little right next to the pillow and then sneak.
I would
back
shit
out.
On the toilet. I mean, I would shit on the pillow. I would break
shit
in,
on the toilet seat.
Shit on the toilet seat. Shit on the pillow. I would.
And then. Give you food poisoning, so in the middle of the night you have to get up to go shit on the toilet. Mm-hmm. But there's shit on the
I'd
seat.
I'd put
already.
Cyanide in your drinks. So don't fuck me, okay? I'm fucking crazy.
Don't ever do that.
I'm just kidding. I probably would never do that. I don't even know where I would buy cyanide.
Me either. Where do people even get that
I don't
stuff?
Know.
I don't get
what's
it.
Up with that? Okay, anyways, moving on. So Anna Maria, she didn't go commit murder. She put her big boots on, big girl panties on, and did what moms have to do in situations like this. And she, along with the oldest son, worked really hard and saved up as much money as they could to move back to the States. It took 3 years, but finally in 1954, she was able to move herself and her children to a suburb of LA. And once there, because of how gifted Rodney was, he attended various private schools on scholarship. He was in all the gifted programs. He like skipped grades, I think, and he ended up graduating from Montebello High School, where he actually like ran track and cross country. He was on the yearbook planning committee, and this is where he fell in love with photography, became his passion. And after graduation, he enlisted in the U.S. Army to become a paratrooper. And you'd think with his level of intelligence that he would rise the ranks like really right. quickly and thrive in the military, but that was absolutely not the case. Instead, he was discharged on medical grounds after just 4 years in 1964. And this is like a long story that differs with every single source that I read. So I'm just going to give you the short version that seems to be the most consistent with all the reports. And basically, it's that he was reported and disciplined after investigations for assaults of several different young women from the surrounding areas of the bases that he had been assigned to. His commanding officer, who had to discipline him for all of these attacks and assaults, made several notes of him being manipulative, vindictive, and insubordinate. And in 1964, after being disciplined for assault on a woman, a heated argument breaks out between him and his commanding officer, and he allegedly experiences what professionals now describe as a nervous breakdown that caused him to go AWOL because he got up, walked out, and hitchhiked from Fort Bragg, North Carolina, to his mother's house in LA.
What?
Yeah. Once he was found,
hitchhiked across the country,
across the entire country, straight across.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I wouldn't even know where to begin. What year?
This is 64.
You didn't have Apple Maps.
No.
You're literally trusting a map.
Good luck. And they're like, interstates were, you know, getting down, cars. But they were not like popping.
I need to go west. I guess, yeah, I just got to go west.
Yeah, just take me west. Eventually. Who's heading west? Me. I'll go with you.
Me.
Yeah, not, yeah, you know what I mean. So either way, he ends up being found out, or I don't know if his like mom reported him or if he maybe turned himself in for going AWOL. But either way, he is sent back to Fort Bragg, and a military psychiatrist admits him under his care. And this leads to his very first diagnosis of having antisocial personality disorder. And it was also determined during these testings that he has an IQ of 135, which like only 2% of the population have above 130.
Whoa, we should test our IQ.
No, I don't even want to know. I don't even want to know.
I don't think I have a high IQ. I'm not a good critical thinker.
Does IQ change over time for someone? Because IQ is a collection of a lot of things, you know?
Yeah.
I think if you would have taken my IQ 2 years ago, it would be way higher than it is now.
Well, I think you would have a high IQ because you're a good critical thinker.
Yeah, but I think I would shit during the test and be all ADD like, and not take it.
Is there a free IQ test?
Can someone like come to my house and talk to me and write the answers of the test, but without me having to know that I'm taking a test?
Right.
Because that's when I do the best.
Yeah. See, I would fail at that. Give me a pen and paper.
Yeah, no, I can't handle that. That's the second you put a test in front of me, I have to read things really critically. I'm panicked the entire time and words start flipping upside down and stop making sense.
Yeah.
Like how when I have to read a creepy account that I didn't proofread before. Panic.
Game over.
Sheer panic.
All right. Well, we're going to take our IQs and get back to you guys in season five.
I'm just kidding. I don't even want to know. What if mine's like low? Like
what
really
if,
low?
What if they're like 60?
I guess we can never tell any. Like we would just never tell anyone. It would just be between me and you.
Yeah.
Period. End of story. We never talk about it again.
I think you're like you're my dad's really IQ is yourself. Crazy high. I think you have a high IQ.
My dad's is like, I can't remember. I used to know what his IQ test was, but it was like crazy high.
Why aren't we required as a population to take them every year?
Why not? Like, why don't we take it with the census? What's that about? We should know. Because if you're a genius, get your ass here right now.
Right. Like,
because either you're
a
serial killer or like a fucking genius.
Or you need to work on the new Oak Ridge project. Yeah. Like one or the other.
One or the other. You got to, if you're that high of an
IQ. But I guess like, that's the beauty of the land of the free. No one needs to know that.
But I'm like, everyone should be tested.
All of a sudden, you're like support a part of the Communist Party. Jesus Christ. Everyone must pass. It's like that one show where you literally have to pass the test to live.
Yeah.
And if you like aren't above the IQ
it's
threshold.
It's giving Black Mirror.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Moving on. He has an IQ of 135. And after leaving the military, Rodney Alcala really just kind of starts over. And this is a common theme that you're going to see with him throughout this entire case. He moves into an apartment in the Hollywood Hills. He made several new friends. He built up his photography equipment and portfolio and pretty much immediately enrolled in UCLA's School of Fine Arts, which he graduated from in the summer of 1968. And according to everyone that knew him during this time, like professors, peers, so on and so forth, he was considered to be so nice, a really good dude, like would go and feed your cat if you needed to go on vacation and walk your dog if you couldn't make it home. He was charming, he was adventurous, he was gentle and creative. So you're probably asking, like, okay, well, you said that the tip that connected him to Robin's case had to do with him being on parole. So what's that about?
Yeah, why is he on parole? This sounds like he's doing good.
A horrific crime that he should have been sentenced to life in prison for.
Okay.
And I'm going to tell you about it right now. So, trigger warning. I know we got a little fun there for just 1 second.
Yeah,
but
bring it back down. Got it.
This is a child and it's sad. So it's September 25th, 1968 in Los Angeles, California. And 8-year-old Tally Shapiro was walking home from school when a beige sedan pulled up beside her. Driving the car was a dark-haired man that looked to be in his mid-20s, and he asked Tally if she would want to ride home. Tally, being the smart little girl that she is, tells the man that she isn't allowed to talk with strangers and for sure not allowed to get in cars with strangers, right. So she starts to walk back off. But before she could even take one step, the man says, "You're so smart and you're so right, sweetie, but I know your parents and they told me it was okay to come get you because I have a beautiful picture that they said you would love to see." And Tally thought on it and eventually got into the car excited to see this photo. The man drives Tally through the busy streets of LA before arriving at his apartment complex not too far away located in the Hollywood Hills, where Tally and the man went inside his apartment. Now, what the man that Tally was with didn't know was that they were being followed by a guardian angel whose name I unfortunately could not find anywhere, but we're going to call him John. John was behind the man in the beige sedan when he pulled over to talk with Tally. And instead of just driving around the stopped car, John decided to just wait because something felt wrong in his gut.
Wow.
Meaning John watched as this little girl was coached into the beige car. And again, knowing something was off, not just because the interaction with the little girl was weird, but because also this beige car clearly had its license plate recently removed, John decides to follow the beige car with the man and Tally inside. He follows them all the way to that apartment complex, where John sat in his car and watched as Tally and this man walked inside his apartment. John noted the apartment number and immediately drove to the closest payphone where he called 911. What's really interesting to me about this call is the fact that it was followed up on so quickly because, I mean, within minutes of John reporting this to the police, LAPD had officers and detectives at the complex, like, within seconds.
Wow.
It was as if, even through the phone, everyone knew that something was going on bad. and had that same gut feeling that John did. The first detective on the scene was named Chris, and seconds after being briefed on the apartment number by John, he walks up to the door and knocks, calling out the classic LAPD, open up. A few seconds later, the door cracks open and the man from the beige car, sort of like pokes his head out. And he tells Detective Chris, "So sorry, dude, I was in the shower. Just give me 1 second. I need to put some clothes on and just have my towel around me." Now, looking in this man's eyes, Detective Chris knew that this man had a dark, evil soul. So much so that it made him uneasy standing there. Like his body reacted to the feeling of danger being near this man. Trying not to startle him so he wouldn't run and keep control of the situation, Detective Chris tells the man, "That's fine, but you have 10 seconds to throw on some shorts and come to the store and open it all the way. And if you don't do this by the time I get to 10, I'm knocking the fucking door down." The man's like, "Yep, no problem. Give me 2 seconds." And he hears the man run into the apartment and start messing around with some clothes, he assumes. And Detective Chris starts counting out loud. 1, 2, 3. And when he gets to 10, there is a silence from inside the apartment. A deafening silence. So without missing a beat, Detective Chris kicks down the door and he screams out to the other several officers that were under him on the stairs preparing to be his backup. They come running up into the apartment behind Detective Chris. And as Chris stumbles into the house over the busted door, what he walked into would shock everyone because lying on the floor of the kitchen in a pool of blood was the body of Tally Shapiro.
Oh my God.
The little girl that John had just watched get into this man's car, with her white Mary Jane shoes sitting off to the side of her body. It was obvious to the naked eye that Tally had been beaten with a heavy metal bar that was still lying across her throat. Tally was not moving or breathing. As the officers are making their way through the apartment and tending to Tally, they cannot find the man anywhere. He had ran out the back door and was nowhere in sight. And in all this chaos, Detective Chris hears something. He tells everyone in the apartment to stop moving and stop making noise. And they realize that the sound was coming from Tally. She was clinging on to life. The officers rushed Tally out of the apartment into an ambulance where EMTs immediately began stabilizing her as they rushed her to the closest hospital. Tally was not only beaten and strangled, but they discovered she had been raped. Life-saving measures were performed at the hospital where Tally would spend the next 32 days in a coma and several months recovering. But thankfully, just to give you guys some peace of mind while I finish her story, she did survive.
Wow.
As soon as Tally is sent off to the hospital, Detective Chris and CSI began combing through the entire apartment. They found tons and tons of photography equipment, photos that they assume had been taken by the suspect, and several of these photos were of young women in vulnerable locations and positions. And thankfully, alongside all of these photos that they had found, they also discovered photo IDs, specifically UCLA student IDs, with their suspect's name and face on them, which is how they first learned the name of 25-year-old Rodney Alcala. He was immediately placed on the FBI's most wanted list and a manhunt ensued, but Alcala was long gone and had fled the state. By mid-1969, we know that Rodney Alcala was living in New York City under the name John Berger, B-E-R-G-E-R, which is an important thing to remember. He enrolls at NYU and studies film under the Roman Polanski, made friends there, made a whole new life for himself, still pursuing photography, keeps his camera with him at all times. And at the beginning of night, and he stays there until at least 1971, when at the beginning of 1971, he was moved up to the FBI's top 10 most wanted list. And soon after this announcement went public, we know that Alcala in June of 1971 abruptly seemed to just like pack up his life in New York and move to New Hampshire. And when he gets to New Hampshire, he starts using a slightly different alias, which is John Berger, but spelled B-U-R-G-E-R.
Like a hamburger.
Like a hamburger. He gets a job in New Hampshire at a arts and drama camp for young girls as a counselor, where the campers loved working with him. Well, one day, two of the girls from the camp had walked to the post office to mail out some letters home. And as they're waiting in the line, they're just kind of chatting and looking around when they see this like corkboard that had the FBI top 10 most wanted list with photos. And they recognized one of those photos as being their favorite counselor, Mr. John Berger. The girls rip the flyer off the wall, shove it into their pockets, hiding it, and rush back to camp, immediately taking this flyer to the dean of the camp, who then quickly and very quietly called 911. Within minutes, police surrounded the camp and arrested 28-year-old John Berger, aka Rodney Alcala, shipping him back to California, where there he was charged with the kidnapping, rape, and attempted murder of 8-year-old Tally Shapiro. The prosecution began to prepare to take Alcala to trial. However, by this point, Tally's family had moved to Mexico for Tally's safety and recovery. And when asked if they would bring their now 11-year-old daughter back to California to testify against her attacker, her parents said, absolutely not. We are right. not doing that. Their daughter would not be forced to sit face to face with her attacker if she did not want to. And Tally very much at 11 years old did not want to. Though they were 100% doing the right thing by protecting their daughter, which I stand by, because of this, unfortunately, they could only charge and convict him with child molestation, which he pled guilty to in a plea deal. So Rodney Alcala was sentenced to 1 year to life by a fucking insane judge that blew everyone's mind. Like the prosecution, the detectives were fucking livid, losing their minds. And the only thing was is that he just had to register as a sex offender and serve a year to life or whatever. He ends up being let out on parole after only serving 34 months.
How are you on the top 10 FBI most wanted list and only get
34 months?
34 months in jail.
Right. And you have to be a registered sex offender and then you have to be on parole. That's it?
Yeah.
Are you That's fucking crazy. Kidding me? I know that she's an 11-year-old little girl. What do you mean? Make right. an exception.
Right.
Make it work. So
That's crazy. They shouldn't have had to fully rely on this 11-year-old's test.
Right, exactly.
That's bullshit.
So he's released on parole in 1974, which fucking pissed everyone off. Like the prosecutors, all the like detectives and shit, like went and fought this judge over it. But he was released. Well, they were right and the judge was wrong, because less than 2 months after this release, he is arrested for a second time, this time for the assault of a 13-year-old girl who is referred to in the records as Julie J, after she accepted a ride home from school from Alcala. And thankfully, she was able to escape and report him after he attempted to rape and assault her. And somehow, after being arrested while being, because it's breaking a violation parole. Of parole and you're a registered sex offender, somehow he only served 2 years for this second attack and he was released on parole once again in 1976.
Wow.
Miraculously, despite being a major flight risk, as he had already fled once and he is a repeat offender because he was arrested 2 times back to back, Alcala's request for a cross-country road trip to New York was approved.
Oh, perfect.
And why not? Perfect. So that was approved for him to go in June of 1977. So just like 6 months after he got released, and he hops in the car and he starts road tripping all the way from LA to New York City.
I guess at least he asked.
Yep. Stopping in several states along the way. Alcala returns to LA from this trip sometime in the fall of 1977, where he just kind of once again picks back up and starts life over. By 1978, he has made several new friends. He is working as a typesetter for the LA Times and is shooting tons of weddings and birthdays in the area, building his portfolio. When he gets selected to be a contestant on a hit TV game show called The Dating Game.
Oh my God.
This was an ABC TV game show hosted by Jim Lang, where a bachelorette would be selected and she would question three random anonymous bachelors that were hidden from her view. And once all the questions were asked, she would select of the three men which one she wanted to accompany her on a date that was paid for by the show, at which point all three contestants would be revealed to the bachelorette after she had picked. How he got on this show and working with the LA Times and wedding and birthday photographers.
No one background checks.
As a registered sex offender, I will never understand, especially you, ABC. Either way, Rodney Alcala was one of the three bachelors chosen to go on the show with the bachelorette Cheryl Bradshaw. And he was introduced as, quote, a successful photographer who in between takes you might find skydiving or motorcycling. And he won.
That those were his interests?
Yeah. Cheryl selected him as the lucky winner of her complimentary date. Guys, you can go and watch that whole episode on YouTube. It's like, in hindsight's 2020. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's so disturbing. I couldn't even watch it all the way through just because of how it made me feel.
Yeah.
So you guys can go watch it though. It's on YouTube. So he wins the complimentary date with Cheryl. However, after the show wrapped and she was like speaking with Alcala backstage, she like goes to the producers and was like, do not give him my contact information. Something's weird about him. He's creepy. I'm not going on a date with him.
Does the show like follow up on dates? Like, did she have to?
No, she didn't have to. Okay. Yeah. I think she might have ended up going with another one of the guys, but one of the other two guys that were on there with him did say in an interview, like, something was so wrong with him. Like, it was like he was uncanny valley almost, like where you see a human that's acting like they're human. Yeah. Like what an alien would look like, you know, if they were trying to act like a normal human in a human skin suit, you know. Another thing that happened to Alcala in 1978, in addition to all of this, and I'm not exactly sure on the timeline of when this happened in 1978, but I know for sure that he was formally questioned as a person of interest in the Hillside Strangler case due to his proximity to the crimes, his history, and the fact that he's a registered sex offender. However, he was released because, as we know now, he was not one of the Hillside Stranglers, because there's two. Have I ever covered them? No, I don't think so. I have.
Does not sound familiar.
One of these days. Maybe in season five. Okay. So 4 months before Robin went missing, this time it's February 14th, 1979, and Robin went missing, was abducted and murdered in June of 1979. Alcala was arrested for the fourth time after picking up a 15-year-old little girl named Monique Hoyt, who was hitchhiking in Riverside County, California. He took Monique to his apartment where he raped, beat, and bound her. He then put her in his car, took her to a mountainous area near Banning, California, where he took photos of her in her underwear and raped her in this like field or vacant lot for a second time, taking photos of himself as he did this. Then he rebound and regagged her, raped her again, sodomized her for a third time before bludgeoning her in the head with a rock. He then put her back into his car as she was barely conscious and began driving her back to his apartment in Hollywood Hills. On the drive home, though, he stopped at a gas station to use the restroom, thinking that Monique was unconscious. So he just like left her in the car with the car doors unlocked. But what he didn't know is that she was plain dead. So the second that door shut to the bathroom inside the gas station, she jumps out of the car and runs. She hides somewhere. She watches as he comes out, realizes that she's gone. He like looks around, but then panics, jumps in the car and speeds off. Monique was able to go to a hospital or a police station somewhere to get help. Wow. Where she reported the attack and got him arrested. And I don't know if she like knew his name or if like the description in the car and they the style of attack, they just knew it was him. But despite him being on fucking parole
again,
violating parole for the second time and being a repeat offender, he was released because his mother paid his fucking bail and nothing happened after that.
Wow.
Yeah. That's what investigators learned about Alcala after receiving this tip from his parole officer in connection to Robin's case.
Oh my God, I forgot. Okay.
Yeah. So this is where, guys, LA. I told this to Morgan in the beginning before we got on mic, but like, I'm taking you guys in down the order of events of how investigators learned who the dating game killer was. So you're going to see, like, there's going to be a lot of hopping back and forth on timelines as new things come and new evidence comes forward. So just bear with me that's where we're at. So we started with Robin.
And you're so right about how he gives BTK.
Yes, 100%. So
mindful.
That's what investigators learn when they receive that tip from his parole officer in connection to the murder and kidnapping of 12-year-old Robin Samso. And immediately the detectives knew that Rodney Alcala was their fucking guy. Because he was on parole and a registered sex offender, investigators had no problem locating him this time. So on July 24th, 1979, 22 days after Robin's remains were discovered, Huntington Beach police pulled up to Rodney Alcala's mom's house where he was living at the time and happened to be right beside the location that Robin was discovered. They arrested and charged him with the kidnapping and first degree murder of Robin. And then they continued to search through the entire home for evidence as he was taken to jail where he stayed raid and awaited trial. Now, during the search of his mother's home at the time of his arrest, investigators collected several pieces of evidence, or clues, I should say, because though they were able to collect a few things, they knew that he had done something with his photography collection and equipment because it was nowhere to be found. But what they did find, though, was a receipt for a storage locker. Now, it didn't say where the storage locker was located or anything like that, but it showed the date of purchase being just 9 days after Robin Samso's body was discovered. Well, you know, he's in jail being held or whatever, so his sister comes in to visit with him. And they're chatting back and forth like in one of those window booths where you talk on the phone, having no idea that this line's being recorded. And guess who's listening in? Detectives.
Right.
So being the dumbass that he is, thankfully, he's like, hey, sis, can you do me a favor? And she's like, yeah, sure. What's up? And he's like, look, I've got this secret storage locker in Seattle, Washington that no one, not even mom, not the cops, no one knows about. And I need you to go there, clear it out completely. And I don't give a fuck what you do with what's inside. She agrees, they finish their conversation, and she leaves. Well, the second she's out, detectives are already in the car heading to Seattle because they have to beat her to the storage locker.
Also, what, like, I understand that this is your brother, but what human being in the right mind would be like,
yeah,
knowing everything?
Yeah, no problem.
Not go straight to police and be like, hey, he just told me, storage right. locker.
Because now, baby, look it. What you are, an accessory.
Right.
Yeah. So they get to the storage locker, they locate it, they get the key, they get it open, and it was the mother load. Inside this locker, investigators found tons of photography equipment and hundreds of thousands of photos of young girls.
Oh my God.
In remote, vulnerable locations and poses. And buried beneath all of these photo albums and boxes of shit, detectives discovered a small silk red coin purse. They open it up, and inside they find several pairs of girls' earrings. Investigators seized everything from inside the locker and took this little coin purse with the earrings back to Alcala to question him. He immediately claims that they belong to him. These are his family heirlooms. He wanted to keep them in the locker so they would be safe. Okay, shut the fuck up. But what he didn't know was that investigators had already shown all of the earrings to Marianne, Robin's mother. And she had identified one of these pairs, it was a gold ball stud pair, as being a pair that she had allowed Robin to borrow and were missing from her jewelry box.
Wow.
So, guilty as sin. The trial began in early February 1980 and lasted 2.5 months with over 50 witnesses brought forward to testify against Alcala. In May of 1980, Alcala was found guilty for the kidnapping and first degree murder of 12-year-old Robin Samso. And in June of that same year, he was sentenced to death. For the next 4 years, Rodney Alcala continuously appealed all of these rulings, studying criminal law while being held at San Quentin and searching for loopholes to try and get himself out. Because remember, he's a fucking genius. And in 1984, he found one when the California Supreme Court shockingly overturned his guilty verdict and sentencing, claiming that Alcala did not receive a fair trial because it was discovered that jurors were, quote, improperly told about Alcala's prior sex crimes, including the attack of Tally Shapiro when they weren't supposed to, end quote.
I think that's everything that a jury needs to know, actually.
Wait, what do you mean? Like, we can't talk about something that he is guilty
obviously
of?
Obviously, clearly repeating the process every again? Couple years, right. If not more, that we don't know about.
Right.
And you don't think that's important information for a jury to decide whether this man is behind bars for the rest of his life or another year of parole or a couple of years?
Yeah,
you know?
Just get let off. Yeah. Nope. He was not released, thankfully, because they have enough evidence to hold him, but a new trial date was set for February of 1986. And after virtually the same exact trial as the first, except for this time really making sure that the jury never figures out about his previous crimes, in May of 1986, Rodney Alcala was found guilty for a second time and once again sentenced to death, which he continued to appeal. In some fucking hell, Morgan, he finds another loophole. This time, only getting his sentencing verdict overturned, so he's technically still guilty of the kidnapping and first-degree murder of Robin, but they have to do a third trial all over again in order to get his sentencing with a new jury. And this time, it was overturned in 2001 by a United States District Court judge because he filed a federal habeas corpus petition in 1992 that was accepted in 2001 when it got overturned, claiming that he was not allowed to show evidence that he had in the second trial that he should have been allowed to show. That like habeas corpus or whatever it is, it basically means that you didn't have a right to a fair trial and that there was like prejudice against you.
Well, sometimes I do have prejudice
against you, fucking Alcala dude. What do you mean? You're a registered sex offender.
How does someone not?
Sorry.
How do you ask 12 jurors to sit there and not have prejudice against
them? Right. Like you don't even have to tell me the full story.
Right.
I can hear the first two sentences and be done.
Right.
Yeah. Basically, he was honestly just doing every single thing in his power to continue to torture Robin's family because he was mad at them for getting him put behind bars. So the California prosecutors tried every single thing that they could to avoid a third trial, avoid having to drag Robin's family through this because they keep having to testify and relive and relook at all the crime scene photos and hear the story over and over again. But by 2003, after 2 years of fighting this shit, they were basically told to suck it up and just do it right this time. Yeah.
I'm sorry. How about you, the state of California? But, do it fucking right.
It was a blessing in disguise because this long, drawn out process kind of led to them getting a call that would turn this case upside down. Because the second they basically put their tail between their legs and were like, fine, we're just going to fucking do it again. And we're going to do it so by the book that it hurts. Mm-hmm. They get this call and... Before we go into it, let me give you a little bit of a reality check about where we are in the timeline of life. So it's at this point, 2003. Rodney Alcala is in his 60s and it's been almost 25 years since Robin was murdered. So her family's been going through this for 25 years and 35 years since the attack on Tally Shapiro. And as we all know, during that 35 year period since his first known attack of Tally, there were tons of advancements in technology. But specifically, I am referring to databases and the holy grail that is DNA to aid in law enforcement investigations. And at this time, the databases, 2003, were growing and expanding every single day by hundreds. And more convicted violent attackers, DNA and prints are being logged in from prisons all around the United States alongside thousands and thousands of unsolved cold cases being retested, rape kits that are finally being processed and have somewhere to go and do something. And they're finding evidence that we didn't even know was possible through forensic analysis. Meaning Rodney Alcala, because he's a convicted violent felon, repeat offender, his DNA had legally been extracted and put into these databases. And boom, 4 additional cold cases from California are linked to Rodney Alcala through his DNA and fingerprints in the databases. These are the cold, violent cases and disturbing murders of 18-year-old Jill Terry Barkham from November of 1977, 27-year-old Georgia Marie Wickstead from December of 1977, 31-year-old Charlotte Lee Lamb from June of 1978, and 21-year-old Jill Marie Parento from June of 1979. And these are their stories.
Hold up. We have to turn y'all on to something. If you're like us and are always on the hunt for products that genuinely will improve your life, then listen up. We need to tell you about our absolute favorite product. It's Lumi's Whole Body Deodorant Stick.
And we first realized just how much we love these products when we were recently traveling in California and got to the hotel and opened up our toiletry bags and they were loaded down with Lumi. Number one being those deodorant wipes. They have 24-hour odor control for pits, privates, feet, and beyond because, guys, this was developed by an OBGYN and it feels like you're literally taking a shower without having to take the time to take a shower. Did I mention that it smells so good? Like, just some examples of my favorite body wash scents are Clean Tangerine and Lavender Sage. Morgan, what's yours?
I love the Toasted Coconut, and then even Aaron had forgotten his deodorant at Disney. So lucky for him, we had a brand new fresh Alpine deodorant.
And
he loved it.
He did. He was like, kind of obsessed.
Yeah. Lumi is seriously safe to use any anywhere on your body. The pits, the underboobs, the thigh folds, belly buttons, butt cracks, vulvas, and feet. Because like we said, it was created by an OBGYN.
It's clinically proven to block odor all day and have odor control for up to 72 hours.
It's baking soda free and paraben free and pH balanced for safe use below the belt. Lumi Starter Pack is perfect for new customers. It comes with a solid stick deodorant, cream tube deodorant, two free products of your choice like the mini body wash or the deodorant wipes.
Our faves.
And free shipping.
As a special offer for our besties, new customers get 15% off all Lumi products with our exclusive code. And if you combine that 15% off with the already discounted starter pack, that equals over 40% off of their starter pack, guys. So besties, head over to Lumi and use code Creeps and Crimes for 15% off of your first purchase at LumiDeodorant.com.
That's code Creeps and Crimes at LumiDeodorant.com.
Wow. On November 9th, 1977, which would have been after Alcala had returned home from LA after his cross-country New York road trip following his second release. So he had gone to New York and come back in the fall of 1977. This is right after.
So he really has no MO. He's like an opportunity, like.
Yes, but like we see what he does in the attacks is similar okay, every time. Time, but he's like a thrill. Age, it's like a
like victim profile clearly doesn't matter as long as it's a woman.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Sicko.
So he had just gotten back to LA after his cross-country road trip. It's November 9th, 1977. And 18-year-old Jill Terry Barcom was picked up by Alcala while hitchhiking. Though we don't know exactly what happened in the time between, her body was found the next day on a dirt path near Mulholland Drive in LA. She was discovered in the fetal position and naked from the waist down with various signs of sexual assault, including three defined bite marks on her right breast and a brutal beating. She had been bound and strangled with a pair of blue rope ties that were found on her body at the time of her discovery. Initially, the case of Jill was thought to have been the doing of the Hillside Stranglers. However, DNA from her body came up as a match to Rodney Alcala in 2003. Just over a month later, after Jill's attack and murder, on December 16th, 1977, 27-year-old Georgia Marie Wickstead was found dead in her Malibu apartment. Georgia was a nurse and was last seen dropping off her coworker at her coworker's house from a bar the night before after they had gotten off their shift. They had like gone to drink and have dinner together, and then she took her bestie home, and then she went back to her house. Well, the next day, when Georgia did not show up to work her shift, her friends from work reported her missing to the police because Georgia would never no call no show. Something had to be wrong. So police go to her apartment to perform a welfare check, and immediately when they walked up on the front porch, they noticed very clear signs of forced entry. They entered the apartment and found Georgia posed naked on the floor of her bedroom and strangled with her own nylon stockings. She had been bashed in the skull with a blunt object, sexually assaulted, and her genitals had been mutilated. Her case sat cold until 2003 when DNA and a handprint from the crime scene connected her to Alcala. 6 months later, on June 24th, 1978, which would have been right after the dating game show, 31-year-old legal secretary from Santa Monica, Charlotte Lee Lamb, was found dead in the laundry room of her apartment complex. She had been beaten, sexually assaulted, and strangled with a shoelace. After her death, her body was posed with her hands behind her back on the floor. DNA from the scene and a pair of earrings found in that storage locker coin purse connected Charlotte's case to Alcala. In between Charlotte and his next victim was the attack on Monique Hoyt on February 14th, 1979. 4 months after that attack on Monique, on June 13th, 1979, 21-year-old Jill Marie Parento left her job as a computer key punch operator early that day to go watch a basketball game. Now, the next day, she did not show up for work, so she was reported missing by her coworkers because just like Georgia, no way, no how she's going to no call, no show. So they report her missing to police. Police go to her Burbank apartment to do a welfare check, and just like in Georgia's case, police immediately noticed signs of forced entry at the front door, and they entered. Her body was found naked on the floor of her bathroom, posed with pillows underneath her shoulders. She had been beaten, strangled, and sexually assaulted. Her attacker had fled through a broken window in a hurry, so they don't know what happened, but something must have scared them because he jumps through the window and scrapes his arm or hand, leaving blood behind, and that would be what later connected Alcala to the attack on Jill. After this connection, Jill's best friend identified Alcala as a man that she and Jill had seen and chatted with several times at local bars and clubs in the months before her attack.
Wow.
So with all these new connections to these cold cases using DNA and the absolute complete hatred of Rodney Alcala, the California prosecutors essentially throw a bold as hell Hail Mary by deciding to add all of these additional cases, so the four cold cases, into their trial. So now, instead of just trying him for the murder of Robin, they are wanting to bring all five cases to the jury to ensure that he would not walk free another day of his life, which was approved. They had to go get it approved because they were like, we know better than to not take every single step. They go and they get this approved by the California Supreme Court in 2006. And the reason that this is like a really bold move for them to try him for all five of these crimes at the same exact time is because it's literally, as a prosecutor, putting all of your eggs in one basket. You are literally giving yourself no backup option.
Right.
Because let's say he doesn't get convicted for all five of these crimes and he ends up getting a not guilty verdict, he can walk free and there's no double jeopardy.
Right.
You know? So
risky
as fuck.
At this time, when they were making these connections, were they questioning him about these four murders, or were they keeping this under wraps?
He,
you know,
he was questioned about them, and
okay, so he knew that
he pled
was
not guilty to.
Okay,
well, he knew he was being investigated for, but this will make sense when I get into the trial. But either way, I guess their reasoning for making this decision to try all five at the same time was because they learned about the bold ass move that Alcala was making for himself. And by bold, I mean like the most classic narcissistic dumb ass move that people like him make.
Insanity.
Which is, no, even worse. He, in his own, like, it's literally detrimental to himself. He says, guys, I don't need a defense attorney. I'm representing myself.
No, yep. He didn't.
He is representing himself in court, baby.
Okay, I would say that sounds great. Thank you. Sign here.
Against five total first-degree murder charges that all have DNA concrete evidence attached to them. Like, you're going down.
Also, at this time, though, question, you probably might know this, maybe not. DNA was solid evidence in the court. It was accepted by the, because it wasn't at first,
but at this point it's gone on for so long because they've been putting off taking him to trial where they figure out these other ones. So it's 2006. It's 2006 now, so having this concrete DNA is no problem for them. Yeah, okay. He's representing himself in court against these five total murder charges with the concrete evidence. And the trial is set for February 2010. So it's even more reliable with DNA. Oh, no, I just clicked off.
Well, good thing you got titles and color code.
I know. Thank God. Thank God.
And don't worry, I can grab your notebook.
Good luck. There's marks and highlights all the way down it. Okay. The trial begins February 2010 with 66-year-old Alcala sporting a gray suit and referring to himself as Mr. Alcala in a very different, weird voice than his own when he's cross-examining himself on the stand for 5 fucking hours.
What?
And to sum this like whole trial up, essentially, the defense, aka Alcala, is arguing not that he didn't commit the crimes, but instead that he can't remember committing the crime. So trying to get insanity, I think. And he uses the testimony of a psychiatrist named Richard Rappaport, which I know that name. Like, I swear to God.
Rappaport. That does sound familiar.
Yeah.
Statue of Limitations. Was this a thing?
Murder. No. Anything murder, you can get.
Yeah, but didn't that just change? No. Wasn't it 30 years?
No. First degree murder is... got nothing on it. There was something that we talked about in the past. It was like in the 50s, though.
Yeah,
it was like way back then. Yeah. And I think it was in California that it was like
that's why I was thinking that. Yeah, we have talked about
no
that.
There's no statute of limitations right now. So the defense, aka Alcala, arguing that he didn't remember doing the crimes, not that he didn't do them, but he just can't remember them. And he has the testimony of this psychiatrist.
Can't remember the crimes, can't do the time.
And Alcala
was that his argument?
Yeah, basically. He had hired this Richard psychiatrist dude to come and like examine him and then testify for him. This is his only witness that he had other than himself. And this Richard psychiatrist dude, he diagnosed Alcala with borderline personality disorder. So back when he was with the military, it was antisocial mm-hmm. personality disorder. Now it's borderline personality disorder, which Richard Rappaport testified could explain him having this diagnosis, could explain his lack of memory of committing the crimes. But the prosecution argued back, saying that Alcala was a sexual predator who knew exactly what he was doing, and he knew that it was wrong, but he just didn't fucking care.
Right.
Though he only had one witness to testify on his behalf, that psychiatrist, Alcala did call witnesses from the prosecution to the stand. One in particular being Marianne, Robin's mother.
He called the mother to the stand.
So he could.
Because he's literally torturing them.
Yep. So he does this in an attempt to put her character into question for literally no reason.
Yeah, for what?
It should have never been allowed. Like, the court should never have allowed this. But they did. And basically, she basically was like, I don't give a fuck. I'll do not give a fuck. We've gone through this. This is our third time. You're going to die in jail, dude. Right. Even if it's the last, my last breath is me making sure of that, I will do it.
Right.
Because that's what mama bears do, bitch. Mm-hmm. So basically, he calls her up to the stand and questions her about these rumors that had gone around after the first trial, where she had allegedly, very illegally, brought a gun into the courtroom every day of the first trial with the intentions of shooting and killing him if given the opportunity. So he asked her about this on the stand, and Marianne says, yeah, 100%.
Good.
Yeah, 100% I did. And I was given the opportunity, but I didn't take it. Not for you, though, but for my daughter. And when asked to expand on this, Marianne explains, and I didn't type this out because I just want to tell it to you from my heart, because it truly, it like got to me. So she said that it was like towards the end of the first trial, and she's sitting in court. She's got her purse on her. That's where her gun is. It's sitting in her purse. And she gets a clear, perfect shot of Rodney Alcala's head. No one in the way. So she puts her hand down into her purse. She grips the handle of the gun. She puts her finger on the trigger. She flips off the safety and she starts to pull her hand out of the purse. She's going to take that fucking shot, and she's going to go to jail for the rest of her life, and she's okay with it. And as she starts lifting it up, her hand's stuck. It's not stuck on anything. She just like couldn't move it. It went numb. And all of a sudden, her entire right hand that's holding the gun is warm, as if someone reached over and grabbed your hand.
Chills.
And then as her hand gets warm, as if someone's holding it, she gets this little breeze and the smell of Robin's shampoo and conditioner fill her nose.
Oh, man.
And she said that she like got choked up, like she hadn't smelt her daughter.
Yeah.
And she knew that it was her daughter being like, don't do this, mama. Mm-hmm. Like, don't do it. So she released the gun and she didn't take the shot.
Chills.
And she says that to his face in court.
But I could have if I would have, if I wanted to.
But I wanted to, and I was going to. You were going to die at my hands.
Yeah.
But my daughter, who you murdered, saved you. So, after 2 days of deliberation in March of 2010, Rodney Alcala was found guilty on all five charges and sentenced to death for a third time after the powerful testimony of a surprise witness for the prosecution during the sentencing. It was a ghost from Alcala's past, Tally Shapiro. One of his earliest victims, a survivor of the dating game killer who was now in her 50s and finally got the opportunity to testify against him on her own terms.
Wow.
Immediately following the trial, the California Police Department released 120 photos from Alcala's collection of these young girls and women to the public, as they had not been identified, in hopes of determining if any of these individuals were additional victims of his. Over 900 photos, though, could not be released to the public because they were so explicit and disturbing. But within a few weeks of these 120 appropriate photos being sent out, approximately 21 women came forward and identified themselves in the photos, along with six families coming forward claiming that they recognize some of the photos as being their loved ones that just disappeared one day and never came home.
Wow.
Also, that same month.
I mean, he is like prolific. Like he.
Morgan, I'm only halfway through the notes.
I mean, is he like, he's the most.
He has over 130 victims.
And that has to be like the most, right?
I sounds like it. I don't know. No one knows.
Wow. I've never even heard of him.
Yeah.
Good. I'm glad. Yeah.
I don't ever want to hear about him. Who knows? Either way, that same month. So again, you know, he just got his third sentencing and guilty verdict. It's March of 2010. They released those pictures right after the trial wraps. And within days, detectives in New York contact California authorities to alert them of two additional cold cases that were confirmed to be connected to Alcala. Unlike the four from California, though, these were not connected with DNA, but instead dental records, fingerprints, the release of the photos, the matching of aliases that were identified during the trials, and witness descriptions. These are the 1971 and 1977 murders of 23-year-olds Cornelia Crilly or Crilly and Ellen Jane Hover, 6 years apart from each other. Cornelia Crilly was a 23-year-old flight attendant for TWA, Trans World Airlines, living in Manhattan in 1971. On the morning of June 12th, Cornelia woke up energized and excited for the day beside her boyfriend in his apartment where she was crashing, and her boyfriend's name was Leon Borstein, because today was the day that she was going to move into her brand new Manhattan apartment with her very best friend and coworker, another flight attendant from TWA. But she would be moving in all by herself that day because her best friend, the new roomie, was working and wouldn't be back until the next. So her boyfriend, Leon, also had to go to work, and he just was like, look, dude, I promise the second I get off, I'm going to come meet you at the new apartment and we'll carry all the big items over to your new place. So just wait on me. Because also all the shit was in his apartment because she was crashing there. Mm-hmm. So like she's going in and out of his apartment and taking trips to her new one. Leon heads into work. Cornelia begins packing up the, you know, her boxes of clothes and taking them over to the new place. And she starts hanging them up and doing like little tasks like that until the big stuff can be moved with her boyfriend. And later that afternoon, when Leon gets off work, he did exactly as he promised and walked straight to Cornelia's new place, knocking on the front locked door. And to me, this is kind of like when those townhouses, because her front door was to her apartment from the street up a little stoop. Mm-hmm. Okay. He gets off work. He goes over to her new place. He's got like a little sticky note that she had given him with the address and her phone number for the new place. He goes and he knocks on the front door, but there's no answer. So he waits and he knocks and he yells out and he waits and he knocks and nothing. There's no sound. There's no music coming inside, no radio, no footsteps that could be heard. And thinking like, okay, maybe she's in the bathroom and unable to hear me knocking and yelling. Like, I'll just go to the phone and call and she'll hear that. So he goes to the closest payphone and he calls Cornelia's new phone number. No answer. He calls his roommate and learns that Cornelia had not been back to pick up her additional boxes since like several hours before. And Leon's like, what the fuck? Hearing this makes Leon's stomach drop because he just knew something's not right. Something's wrong. It was like, it was a weird static feeling around him. Cornelia maybe got hurt, fell down the stairs, you know, hurt herself when she was carrying stuff. Maybe something fell on her, like needs help. She's stuck. So he just calls 911. He's like, I don't know what's going on, but something's going on. I need someone to show up. Police arrive shortly after at Cornelia's apartment and they meet with Leon on the front steps. They tell him to stay outside as they enter either by force or through like the key from the landlord. But either way, they get in and they search the apartment. Police officers find Cornelia dead on the floor of her empty apartment, lying naked nearby a couch that she had just drug in. Like it wasn't even set up. As if she had gotten help from someone to carry this large couch into her apartment from the street and was then attacked once in the apartment. She had been raped, beaten, strangled, bound, and gagged with her own nylon stocking. Other than an envelope and a letter that was found under her body, which contained a partial but still pretty good fingerprint and very defined bite marks on her right breast, which is a common occurrence here, there was really no evidence to lead them to her killer and there were no witnesses. So it's that cold. Until the fingerprint database connected Cornelia to Alcala, which was then confirmed using Alcala's dental records to compare to the bite marks on her breast, and they were a perfect match. Investigators determined that instead of it being what they initially suspected with Rodney Alcala suddenly moving from New York to New Hampshire, remember in 1971, they thought it was because of the top 10 FBI most wanted raise of him on the list. They realized the reason he fled New York was because of this attack on Cornelia. And if you'll remember, when he switched from New York to New Hampshire, he went from being John Berger, B-E-R, to B-U-R, where he would be found out and arrested at that art and drama camp for young girls. Well, keep those aliases in mind again as I tell you the second New York case This is the case of Ellen Jane Hover. Ellen was the daughter of a prominent Hollywood nightclub owner, Herman Hover, or Hoover, I think it's Hover, and the goddaughter of very famous celebrities, Dean Martin and Sammy Davis Jr. Ellen had moved to New York to go to college and had aspirations of becoming a musician and a model, two careers that she was working really hard to pursue in New York at the age of 23 in July of 1977. For context, at the end of 1976, Alcala was released and paroled after his second arrest for the attack on Julie J and approved for his cross-country road trip to New York City in early June 1977, all of which explains that he had only been in New York for 1 week before he attacked Ellen Jane Hover. On the morning of July 15th, 1977, Ellen's friend drops her off at her Manhattan apartment. By the next morning, after not seeing or hearing from Ellen, her friends and family, you know, started calling her, going by her house, no answers, so they report her missing. Investigators find an appointment on her calendar for the evening of July 15th, the day she went missing, and it was an appointment to have a photo shoot with a man named John Berger, B-E-R-G-E-R. A friend of Ellen's confirmed this and explained to the investigators that the evening before, so on July 14th, when this friend had gone and picked up Ellen to go out for some drinks, they saw this photographer talking to Ellen outside of her apartment on the street. The friend said that the man looked really creepy and just gave like some weird vibes off. So they immediately asked Ellen, like, okay, who the fuck is that guy, when she got in the car with them? And she explained that he was a West Coast photographer that she had just met on the street and had talked to for a little bit, and they had scheduled a shoot together for the next day, the 15th. She was super excited about this because modeling was one of her passions, and the friend didn't really pry anymore because this could have been a really big opportunity for Ellen. Like, that's how shit happened back then. You would meet a photographer, he would take your picture, and you'd become fucking Marilyn Monroe.
Right.
You know, so the friend just let it go. That's how things were back then. The friend gave investigators a description of the man that they saw. Spoiler alert, literally, it's the Rodney Alcala, and they continued to search for Ellen. A year later, in 1978, the skeletal remains of Ellen Jane Hover were discovered buried under heavy rocks on a hillside on the property of the Phillips Memorial Hospital in Westchester, overlooking the Hudson River. This location was just a stone's throw away from the John D. Rockefeller Estate, which was one of the locations that she was scheduled to do this photo shoot with John Berger at.
I also feel like he, you know, got away with it because of like being creepy because he was a photographer, and not to profile, but then photographers and artists, mm-hmm. and they were very eccentric and
and like odd. People would think that they were odd. Yeah,
and they would be like, oh, that's just like that's just how all
they're just artists. Yeah, yeah, they're just creatives. Artists. Yeah, got it.
Not that that's the case, but that's
what people thought back then. Yeah. So witnesses, and you know what? Even still today, like, I find myself being like, oh, like they're an artist. You know, like,
right?
That's their vibe. It's not that they're creepy. It's just like they just walk to the beat of their own drum,
right?
And don't really give a fuck. Yeah, just free spirited. So it can be twisted like that, where right. you're like, oh, it's just a creative. It's mm-hmm. another neurodivergent creative.
Right.
Yeah. Witnesses came forward from the area after she was discovered, claiming to have seen a man matching the friend's description of that photographer in the area on the day of July 15th, 1977, walking with a woman that matched Ellen's description perfectly. Using the alias of John Berger / Berger, B-E-R-B-U-R, plus these witness statements, and I could be wrong, but maybe some photos from that Seattle locker that were found, New York police were able to connect Alcala to the murder of Ellen Jane Hover. At this exact same time, okay, guys, this is all happening in March of 2010. So third trial wraps, he gets sentenced to death, photos go out, New York two cases in. Come forward, another connection.
New Hampshire.
This time, Seattle police call the New York and California authorities, informing them that Rodney Alcala was now their number one person of interest / suspect in three different crimes spanning from 1976, 1977 to 1978. On September 14th, 1976, 20-year-old Cherry Ann Greenman disappeared from Waterville, Washington after being released by the Douglas County Jail. And I think she was like in the drunk take or something. So she like was hitchhiking home and she was never seen again. There was a photo of a woman that very much resembled Cherry discovered in that Seattle storage locker, but her family could not confirm if it was her. Then on July 9th, 1977, 13-year-old Antoinette Jean Whitaker was last seen walking away from her foster home with an unidentified man that matched Alcala's description. A week later, she was found fully clothed, posed propped up on her hands and knees, stabbed to death in a vacant Whoa. Lake City, Seattle lot, which we do know he had posed several other people.
And I bet a lot of those pictures are of deceased.
Yeah. Those 900
women.
Pictures. Mm-hmm. Yeah. She had been stabbed to death, but showed no signs of sexual assault. And there were no photos that had been confirmed or released, at least, that confirmed that Alcala knew Antoinette or like could have potentially crossed paths with her. But despite the lack of sexual assault evidence and photo evidence, if there is any, everything else in this case aligns with his MO. And lastly, for Seattle at least, on February 17th, 1978, 17-year-old Joyce Francine Gaunt was discovered naked, lying face down with her skull crushed at the Stewart Park Seattle picnic area. She had been beaten, strangled, and sexually assaulted, and her last known whereabouts were from the night before, so February 16th, when she left her group home on Capitol Hill with an unidentified man who also matched Alcala's description. Well, a year later, in March of 2011, a year after the photos are released and the New York Seattle connections are made, yet another California cold case was connected to Alcala based on his MO and the victim's story. On October 9th, 1977, 19-year-old Pamela Jean Lamson disappeared after going to meet a male photographer that she had met the day before for a session at Fisherman's Wharf, Marin County, California, which is north of San Francisco. Her body was later found naked and brutally beaten off of a hiking trail nearby the wharf. And though there were no surviving forensic evidence that could link him, there was more than enough concrete evidence based on the circumstances that detectives and everyone knew that this was the doing of Rodney Alcala. So he was charged with that, never really taken to trial, I don't guess. Either way, in June of 2012, so a year later, Rodney Alcala was sent to New York after being indicted by a grand jury for the murders of Cornelia and Ellen, to which he initially pled not guilty. However, 6 months later, in December of 2012, while still being held in New York City, he changes his plea to guilty on both charges for Cornelia and Ellen in order to strike a deal that would get him sent back to California, where he knew he would have a better chance at getting off death row and not being executed. Because at this point in time, it's 2013, like California was overturning that, making, mm-hmm. you know, getting rid of the
death penalty.
West Coast versus East Coast, if you will. Mm-hmm. So he knew he'd have a better chance at not being executed. So on January 7th, 2013, New York officials convicted him on both accounts of first-degree murder for Cornelia and Ellen and sentenced him to two consecutive 25 years to life sentences just in case something ever happened with those five death sentences in California. Since he was 69 years old at this point in time, they knew he was going to die in prison. So they just wanted to make sure that he would never walk free. So after the sentencing, again, that was January 7th, 2013, he's sent back to San Quentin. Months after he was returned, CBS 48 Hours did an episode on Rodney Alcala. And this episode included a call to action for people with missing loved ones to sift through those photos and try and identify more victims. Now, watching this episode when it aired in 2013 was the son of a woman named Kathy Thornton. Her son immediately pulls up those photos and emails the link to his mom calling her because his aunt, Kathy's sister, had been missing since June of 1977. Kathy began sifting through these photos when she came across a photo of a young woman sitting on a motorcycle in a yellow shirt and jeans. It was her sister.
Wow.
In the spring of 1970s.
Can you imagine that feeling?
No, I literally can't. I'm like getting choked up even thinking about it. I would die. In the spring of 1977, 29-year-old Christine Thornton had two big announcements for her mom and little sister, Kathy. First one is that she's pregnant. Woohoo! Second one is that she's moving from her hometown of San Antonio, Texas to Montana with her boyfriend and baby daddy.
Oh.
Yeah.
Woohoo!
And by moving to Montana, I mean like next week she's moving when she announced it. Everyone was really shocked and nervous because her and this boyfriend had a really toxic on and off long-term relationship that was known to be abusive on his part, but she was 29 years old. She's an adult. So what are they going to do?
Right.
You know, so they help Christine get prepared. They pack up her and her boyfriend in their car and they're ready to go from Texas to Montana, waving goodbye to Christine as she yells back, promising that she's going to call once they're settled. Months and months go by, and it's now the end of summer, and there were no calls from Christine or her boyfriend, and no clues as to where she could be. Kathy and her mother reported Christine missing and did everything that they could to try and find her, but all of their efforts were fruitless. They eventually learned that, I don't know how they figured this out, maybe they got in contact with her boyfriend or ex-boyfriend, because they find out that while driving through Biloxi, Mississippi, somewhere in Mississippi, in June of 1977, just after like a month into their cross-country road trip, Christine and her boyfriend got into this huge fight. They break up. Christine grabs all of her shit and's like, I'm hitchhiking back home, and dips. And her boyfriend's like, good for you, even though he's literally her baby daddy. I'm gonna go to Montana.
What?
So he ditches her and she hitchhikes back home, but never makes it. And for context, this lines up perfectly with the timeline and route that Rodney Alcala would have taken after that second release when he was on his cross-country road trip to New York. So Kathy reaches out once she learns this about the breakup in Mississippi to authorities there, and they don't have any record of Christine. They don't have any Jane Doe's, nothing like that. No one matching her description. So more years go by. And in 2013, Kathy's son watches that 48 Hours episode, and Kathy finds Christine's photo. So Kathy, after finding it, uses the resources that are on this website and contacts the authorities. They instruct her that she needs to submit her DNA to the database in hopes that if Christine was murdered and found unidentified, her DNA would ping. Mm-hmm. Kathy did just that immediately, and she waited. So that's 2013, 14, right? In 2015, 38 years after Christine was last seen in Mississippi by her boyfriend, authorities in Sweetwater County, Wyoming, are alerted by the database of a match on a Jane Doe they had. In 1982, this Jane Doe was discovered in Sweetwater County along I-80. Due to the levels of decomposition at the time she was discovered, they could only tell that the victim was somewhere between 28 and 31 years old and was 6 months pregnant at the time of her death. Forensic analysis that was performed at the time of her discovery identified a few tissue samples that were viable, and they saved these. So in 2014, when a cold case unit got assigned this Jane Doe's case, they retested these tissue samples and were able to extract mitochondrial DNA, which is on the mother's side. And this sample was placed into the database, and it immediately connected this Jane Doe to Kathy Thornton. So in 2015, this Jane Doe was formally identified as Christine Thornton. In September of 2016, Rodney Alcala was charged with the murder of 29-year-old Christine Thornton during an interview with Wyoming detectives in his prison hospital room at the Corcoran Prison due to his rapidly declining health and dementia symptoms at the age of 73. However,
Someone like that should never be given dementia in life. Well, no. Yeah.
You should have to remember every single thing. But yeah, you know what? That gets him off.
Right. So then I'm like backtracking. Because if there was any sense of like remorse, like later on in life, like at your end years, like where you're about to meet your maker, then.
And admitting things because like you. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know that I'm kind of at a crossroads with that.
Yeah, definitely. I don't think he really had dementia.
Oh, he wanted to be in a hospital
room. Yeah. I'll tell you why here in a second. You'll see why. So they charge him with this murder of Christine. However, they did not want to give him the luxury of a change of scenery because they were going to have to bring him to Wyoming to try him. So they basically were like, we're just never going to convict him of it. But he's charged. Mm-hmm. They just wanted him to fucking die in this like piece. They said that this was like the room that he was in at Corcoran was like what you would see in a horror movie.
Yeah,
it was disgusting. It was horrible conditions. And they were like, we wanted him to die there. So we left him. Either way, he was never technically convicted because he never admitted to killing her. But he did admit to being in that area when they showed him an area of like where she was found. He said, yep, I know that area. That's my area. I operated there. They show him the photo of her on the motorcycle that he had taken. And they said, like, did you kill her? And they said it was like they watched his brain turn back on. That he went from being like a frail, old, 73-year-old dementia patient to being Rodney Alcala. Because they said that he like sat up a little better. He like smiled a little bit. He had his shoulders back and he says, are you, and he like starts playing.
That man is evil.
He starts playing with them again. He's like, no, are you fucking crazy? I didn't kill her. Are you crazy? She was alive when I left her. Confirming that he knew her and he took this picture and he was there. So like, you admitted to it. We know you did it. And that's what got him the charge, because he admitted to knowing her and taking that photo. And based off the timeline from what the original forensics, autopsies and everything determined and what they know about this timeline that they had hung out together and hitchhiked together, they think that this photo was taken just minutes before she was killed because it was in the exact same area that her body was found.
I hate this guy.
The last really disturbing thing I really feel the need to mention about this, and I didn't even write it down because it was just so gross, is that when they like handed him the photo and like put it on his little table that, you know, sits across someone in a hospital bed, he began tracing her body and smiling, and he did this for 5 minutes.
What the fuck?
And then he started looking at her and tapping on her face on the picture, like hard, and doing it harder and faster. And then when it got like really hard, like bang, bang, bang. After this has been 10 minutes of him doing this shit, he looks over at the detectives and smirks at them and is like, she was alive when I left her.
That man is evil.
Yeah. So
pure evil in him.
It's truly like he just got excited to manipulate again.
Yeah.
You know?
Like snapped him right back.
Right. He was like wanting to play cat and mouse one more time, it feels like. They leave. He's charged. And on July 24th, 2021, Rodney Alcala dies of natural causes in the Corcoran, California prison that they had interviewed him in, the disgusting one, at the age of 77. And July 24th, 2021, his death date, happened to be on the 42nd anniversary of his arrest for the murder of Robin Samso.
Yeah. Robin's like, don't worry, mama. I'll take care of it.
Right. Exactly.
Let him rot for a little.
Right. Just weeks after his death, a call came in to the retired detective from Tally Shapiro's 1968 case, who was named Steve Hodell. He like gets a call at his home because he's retired at this point. And it was from a 68-year-old woman that was named Morgan Rowan. Morgan told Steve Hodell the terrifying and horrific secret that she had been keeping for the last 53 years out of fear that she would be attacked again. Morgan explained that she was attacked by Rodney Alcala in July of 1968, just 2 months before Tally's attack. She was outside of a teen club on Hollywood Sunset Strip when he approached her. He invites her to grab some pancakes from a IHOP nearby, which she accepted and got into his car. Instead of going to the nearby IHOP, though, Alcala drove her to his Hollywood Hills apartment, the same place that he took Tally, claiming that he was having a party. Once inside the quiet, partyless apartment, before Morgan could run, Alcala grabbed her and drug her into his room. He then barricaded them both inside, where he began beating and raping her. Somehow, Morgan's friends had followed her and Rodney to his apartment because they were like, why is she getting in that car, and followed her there. And when they heard her screaming from his apartment, they busted through the windows and the doors, knowing that they could be attacked too, but just like started beating down on Rodney Alcala. He jumps out the window to flee his own apartment. They grab her clothes, they run out the door and they run home. They never call police because they are fucking terrified that he'll come back after her. And because there was this stigma around rape so badly, and that she was terrified. So all these people just kept this secret for 53 years.
That's so sad.
Yeah, and she wanted to wait until the day he died before she reported it. So
wow.
Second that it hit the news and she heard about it, she called it in.
That's so sad.
Over the years, several psychiatrists, psychologists, professionals, behavioral scientists have examined Rodney Alcala, spanning from his time in the military to every single charge, arrest, trial, conviction in between. And here is just a list of a few of his diagnoses, you know what I'm saying? Antisocial personality disorder, narcissistic personality disorder, borderline personality disorder, and malignant narcissism with psychopathy, I think is how you say that, and sexual sadism comorbidities, which means like you have two or more stacked for like fucked up shit.
What a fucked up man.
Yeah. And that's a case of Ronnie Alcala, the dating game killer.
And the state of California and the justice system.
Well, this, it I'm just sorry, shows you
this
that
is on you.
It just literally shows you that Morgan Rowland was so right by not calling it in, because 2 months later, this happens to Tally, and police walked in on it and he was let free.
And we went, what, one, two, three, four different times, or was it three times before he was actually locked away?
We had Tally, Julie, Monique, then Robin.
So it happened three times before he was finally locked away.
Yep.
And I don't know the timeline. I couldn't tell you off the top of my head.
And also, he had been arrested in between also. Oh, the day he, oh my God, in 1978, when he was being questioned about the Hillside, for that case as a person interest in the Hillside Strangler, he was arrested that day when they brought him in, because when they picked him up to bring him in to question him, he had marijuana on him. So they arrested him because it was a violation of his parole. And he was in, he got bailed out again.
You could have saved, if they did this right, the first fucking time. Tally was first. A child. Abducted.
Mm-hmm.
Raped.
Mm-hmm.
Beaten.
And nearly killed.
Nearly dead.
Has to flee the country because for her safety. That's your response, is that you
that
don't fight harder?
Right there would have saved the lives of God knows how many
people. I know, because he's the cases I've told you today are the ones that he is like undoubtedly connected to.
And these, I kind of forget the timeline here, but like majority of those were after Tally, besides Morgan.
Morgan would have been just 2 months before Tally, and that's the crime spree that started in 1968. And it's gappy until the murder of Ellen Jane Hoover, when he went on that cross-country trip right after he got released in 1976, and he goes on that trip in 1977. That started a two-year non-interrupted killing spree with the majority of the victims. But we don't even know of any that could have happened prior or in between, which we know he was killing because we're connecting all these crimes through DNA. But that's only to say that it was a hitchhiker that someone cared about. You know what I mean?
Right.
That got reported.
Right.
There's no telling. There's
sex workers.
There's still over 200 pictures.
People.
Yes. Yeah. Out there of unidentified women could be potential victims of his.
Yeah. That is so fucked up.
Yeah. And there, it does go, okay, I don't remember where this was exactly, but I do know that at like some point, and I want to say it was like while he was at UCLA before the attack on Morgan Rowan and Tally, like where he started kind of
testing his limits
was while he was in school at UCLA, because he was doing like all of these photography sessions with young boys and like making them really sexual and maybe raping the boys, allegedly, but none of the boys came forward afterwards because it was so shameful to them, because there was a lot of photos of young boys that they found in the locker.
That is just one sick fucking individual. Wow.
Yeah, fuck Ronnie Alcala. Hated that.
I've never heard of him.
No, I've heard of the dating game killer in passing. I've never like known the extent. I didn't know that this person, like 130 plus potential victims.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God.
And Google did him so right.
So right.
By making the craziest motherfucking picture I've ever seen in my life. Type in his name on Google. The first image that pops up. Thank you, Google.
Thank you for that. Thank you for just reminding us how fucking terrifying this dude was. Like, truly.
And not, well, thank you for using something like that and not like
a nice picture.
Because I guarantee
like
you,
Ted
if
Bundy.
You look up Ted Bundy, it's not going to be,
it's gonna be like
what
a
he
model
looked like
pic.
Before he died.
Yeah, exactly.
So.
Anyways, guys.
You did great. I loved
last
the coverage.
Case.
I fucking hated the case
of season four.
Mind blowing and sickening. But yep. We'll see ya next week.
See you next week.
Creepy accounts.
Kiss
Two
everyone.
Weeks,
goodbye.
2 weeks getting creepy.
And then we'll get back to cases. And guys, there's gonna be a little extra stuff.
Extra. Read all about it.
Extra. You're like, what could you guys possibly be doing? You bitch and complain about every single thing else that you have to do. We're doing more.
Yep.
Woo! Who's excited? You should be, because it's all for you, my sweet golden girl. Have you guys been watching those people on TikTok? They fucking crack me up.
No, I don't know who that
it's
is.
The blonde guy and the blonde curly hair girl, and she's always like, tonight we go out, my little golden girl, and we are going to paint town.
Oh no,
boots
I don't,
down
I don't see them.
Stomach hurts a little bit, no worries girl, I have a hot coffee dingle.
No, dude, I haven't.
You've got to go watch them on. They're all over my free page.
Did you ever watch that video I sent you this
morning? No, I'm too scared. I've been going through it, Morgan. Do you think I have time to do emotional things?
It was literally a 5-second video, but I was like,
no, the picture made me want to cry. And I was like, I will lose it. I've held it together this entire research. I will lose it.
Oh, man.
I'll watch it tonight when I get in the bed.
Good.
Maybe I'll watch it right before we do Piper Not Goss.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
All right. Love you guys.
Love you guys.
See you next week.
See you next week for Creepy Accounts. Send them in right now.
Bye-bye.
Love ya. Bye.